Are robots of any use in routine gynecologic surgery?
A new device for people with reflux.
What do telomeres have to do with infectious disease?
And volume resuscitating people that are critically ill.
Welcome to PodMed for this week, February 22nd, 2013. That's, of course, the day we post the podcast. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and vice chairman of medicine at the University of Texas, San Antonio.
Rick, I'm really kind of tickled by this one about telomeres. Telomeres, of course, are those little end caps that are on the end of our chromosomes. And as our cells replicate, those things get shorter and shorter. Often as we age, they're implicated in cancer. Now in this study in the Journal of the American Medical Association, looks like they might be implicated in infectious disease susceptibility as well.
As you allude to, Elizabeth, this shorter telomere length is related to a bunch of age-related morbidities and mortalities. You mentioned cancer, but also cardiovascular disease. So this was an interesting study trying to establish whether telomere length in leukocytes, white blood cells, affected the ability of someone to develop an upper respiratory tract infection, a routine cold. And so here's how they did the study. They looked at 152 healthy individuals between the ages of 18 and 55 years old, and they measured the telomere length in their leukocytes. Then they quarantined those individuals and they administered nasal drops that contained the common cold. And they monitored them for 5 days for the development of infection and clinical illness. And what they discovered was that the shorter the telomere length, the much more likely the individuals were to catch the common cold. Those that had the longer telomere lengths, about 50% of them contracted the common cold after exposure to the virus. Those that had the shorter telomere length, between 80 and 85%.
Adding, of course, to this growing body of evidence related to telomeres and overall susceptibility to a variety of conditions.
Yep, this has emerged as kind of a predictor of earlier onset of age-related diseases. Now, the possibility is that the shorter telomere length makes these white blood cells less able to fight infection. The other possibility is that whatever the common genetic abnormality is also predisposes to the common cold. That's why I said this is just an association. It doesn't prove causality at this point.
Since you keep mentioning age then, was there any relationship to age, telomere length, and susceptibility to the cold?
Absolutely. Individuals who were older were more likely to develop cold. They were also more likely to have shorter telomere lengths. But even correcting for age, telomere lengths were still associated with the development of the common cold.
Interesting. We're going to be hearing a lot more about this, of course. We know that. Let's turn then to the New England Journal of Medicine. Many of us in medicine are kind of fond of this idea that robots are somehow going to improve surgical outcomes. And yet, it seems to me that every time this is studied rigorously, robots don't really provide much of an advantage. And I'd have to say that's kind of my take-home message in this study, using robots to do routine hysterectomy.
And as you're aware, hysterectomies are one of the more common surgical procedures performed electively in women. In fact, it's estimated that 1 in 9 women will undergo the procedure during her lifetime. And now surgeons have become very good at doing it laparoscopically. Now we've had this new entry into the market, robotic surgery. And as you suggest, it's gotten the fascination of everybody. Robotic surgery has increased dramatically since its introduction in 2005. And the question is, are there really any benefits over routine laparoscopic surgery? This study looked at almost a quarter of a million women who underwent hysterectomy at 441 hospitals. It tracked the prevalence or how commonly robotic surgery was performed. Did it result in lower complication rates? What was the cost? And what they determined was that over the 3-year period, it increased from 0.5% to almost 10% of the procedures being done robotically. And at hospitals that did it, 22% of the procedures were done robotically. However, it was not associated with a better outcome. There was not a lower complication rate, but it increased the cost about $2,200.
Is the expense due to the equipment outlay up front?
Some of the expense is, but even if you take that completely away, it still ends up being more expensive. It looks like robotic surgery today comes up short. Let me remind our listeners, we're talking about robotic surgery limited to hysterectomies.
Since we're talking about devices then, let's stay in the New England Journal of Medicine and talk about a device for GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disease, or heartburn, let's call it, in the common vernacular. Very, very common condition, and maybe now there's hope for this particular thing using a device.
Gastroesophageal reflux disease is due to an incompetence of the muscle at the end of the esophagus. That's called the lower esophageal sphincter. That should close when a person's not eating to prevent acid from refluxing into the esophagus. It frequently responds to pharmacologic therapy with proton pump inhibitors or antacids. Now, I say frequently, actually about 40% of patients don't respond to that. What do we have to offer them? This is an interesting device. It's implanted laparoscopically, and there are small, high-strength titanium-encased magnets that are wired into an expandable ring. And when they place this around the esophageal sphincter, it increases resistance to the abnormal opening that allows stomach fluids to invade the esophagus, but it still allows food to pass into the stomach. So in this study of 100 individuals that had gastroesophageal reflux that was not responsive to usual therapy, they looked at the percentage of time that there was acid regurgitating back, and they looked at symptoms. And what they discovered is that in two-thirds of the individuals that received the device, there was a significant reduction in acid regurgitation back into the esophagus. So this looks like very promising therapy.
Okay. How much does this thing cost and how troublesome is it to get it in there? You said laparoscopically, but where exactly is it placed?
It's a laparoscopic procedure. It was tolerated well. Now, I say that there were some individuals that had to have the device removed. Of the 100 individuals, six of them had to have it removed. Two-thirds of the people experienced dysphagia, that is difficulty swallowing immediately after the device, but that improved. So at the end of the year, it was only about 10%. So there are some downsides associated with it. This device was just approved by the FDA in March of 2012. This is a preliminary study. It deserves longer-term follow-up, application to a larger number of people, but it looks very promising.
Potentially good news. Finally, then, let's turn back to the Journal of the American Medical Association. Something that is really quite clinical, and I don't think many consumers are going to have a whole lot of familiarity with this particular issue, but this is about restoring blood volume using starch.
There are some studies that we report that our lay, that is our non-medical listeners, can grab hold of and change their lifestyle or can influence our medical care. There are others that are directed towards healthcare personnel, and this is one of them. However, it does have a story that I think our non-medical listeners will be interested in. And that is, how do you resuscitate people that are critically ill? Usually we give them solutions like saline or lactate ringers that are called crystalline solutions. The alternative is something called colloid solutions. These are volume expanders that contain some compound, in this particular study, a starch-related compound, that are meant to expand the volume to resuscitate the individuals. And there's been a lot of controversy about whether these colloidal solutions are as effective or whether they have increased risk. What this meta-analysis did was it tried to look at all the data. What was discovered is that many of the data that contributed to our current guidelines for any of this were contributed by a single individual that recently has been accused of scientific misconduct. There were over 80 articles that this individual published that were retracted. And unfortunately, before this was discovered, the studies were used in the guidelines to suggest that colloids could be given safely and effectively. What this study supports is that when you look at the data, minus those studies, that in fact the use of colloidal volume replacements is associated with an increased risk of death and associated with an increased risk of kidney injury.
I feel really happy that this particular issue has been discerned and that I feel certain it's going to change practice.
It will. In fact, the people that wrote the guidelines are actually revisiting the guidelines in light of this new data. What our listeners need to know is that when we look at a single study, it needs to be validated in other studies. And if there are contradictions and it can't be related to differences in patient populations or different medications or different endpoints, we need to be saying, gosh, were the studies conducted rigorously? Were they conducted in the same way? And are they scientifically valid?
Excellent. So I think that as far as this week's blog is concerned, I'm going to do the telomere length and the induced upper respiratory infections. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
We'll have all the articles posted on our blog. I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.